So, welcome to the Narcisse Bible Study, Shabbat morning, 13 August 2016. We're going to ask the Lord's blessing on us as we read His Word. Lord, we ask that we would be receptive to Your Word, that You would speak to us, to mold us into the image of Jesus Christ. And we pray in Jesus' name and say Amen.
Amen.
Now, last week we didn't read the parasha, so before we read Genesis, I would like to read the parasha to make sure we read it and come back to that. As people know, we are doing a triennial cycle. So this is not the parasha for the annual cycle from Deuteronomy. This is from Genesis 44 today, 44:18 through 46:27. But we have several passages from the Nevi'im, and actually they're all from the Nevi'im. So let me go to Joshua 14, 6 through 15. Joshua 14, 6 and it's an interesting passage. I'm not exactly sure why it was chosen, but listen. Now the people of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, at Kadesh Barnea, about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my fellow Israelites who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt in fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day Moses swore to me, 'The land on your feet, the land your feet have walked on, will be your inheritance. And the land that your children and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the wilderness. So here I am today, 85 years old, and I'm still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now, give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out, just as he said.' Then the Lord blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Hebron used to be called Kiryat Arba, after Arba, who is the greatest man among the Anakites. Then the land had rest from war." And, of course, Arba also means four in Hebrew, and the leader of the Anakites had three sons, and so Arba may have been his name. It may also be referring to the four involved. 1 Kings 1836. I really don't know why 1 Kings 1836 was added to the Parashot readings or the Haftarah of this parasha, but let's read it. This is when Elijah is up on Mount Carmel. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Eliyahu stepped forward and prayed, "Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command." And that was it.
I haven't got the text right. 1 Kings 18:36.
And finally, there is a verse from Amos 9:13, which closes out the book on a very promising note. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper, harvester, will be overtaken by the plowman, and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. And, of course, that's a classic verse as to why in the Bible wine is considered a symbol of blessing. This is a looking forward to the days are coming, and having plenty of wine is a sign of God's blessing for his people. And it seems to be reversed here, the metaphor. The reaper, the harvester, will be overtaken by the plowman. And I see that as meaning the harvest is so great, he just keeps on harvesting and he can't finish. There's so much that the person has to start plowing for the next year before the last year is finished. So the plowman catches up to the harvester. Okay. I think reaper is a bad word because in English we have it as an idiom for the only time I think of hearing that word is in the context of death. And it's just the word harvester. It's a, what do you call it when... What do you call it in when they hire workers that seasonal workers that come in
transient,
like in California,
like they
that. Good words. What do they call them? What?
Seasonal.
I guess farm workers. They're just called farm workers. Seasonal farm workers. So anyway,
the
this
reaper is
very
often reversed the devil. You know, I'm just waiting for the reaper.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was saying. In English, it's in modern English has become a metaphor that is misappropriate for this word, verse. Anyway, the other side, the planter by the one treading the grapes. Well, the one treading the grapes is like the harvester. He's the one that's taking the harvest, processing it. And so here... the planter, the one who's, I guess, getting ready for the next crop, is being overtaken by the one still finishing from the previous crop. So the idea is the same. There is such an abundance of produce that blessings are just overflowing, but the two different actors from the same time period are reversed in the...
But the link here with Genesis is much clearer. Mm-hmm. I mean, the blessing that's going to come, the
years of...
Well, I mean...
Okay, so let's turn to... Now we're with this, we can come back to our topic, to our reading of Genesis 44, and we are finishing this stretch in the life of Joseph of the dysfunctional family, where the brothers are willing to kill their brother. They have been accused of being spies. They're afraid of being accused of being thieves. They've run out of food. They've gone down to Egypt. They have been invited to a banquet with Joseph, and they simply have no framework for interpreting that. Their consciences are giving them only negative interpretations. They are afraid of what's going to happen. And so we enter the scene, the last verse we had read, you know, they were saying, hey, how can we prove our innocence? And Joseph says, far be it from me to do such a thing. He's not going to make them all guilty. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you go back to your father in peace. And so their worst fears have come to pass. They had to convince their father, who was in some ways also guilty with them. They all stayed. They didn't send them back to ransom Levi. Shimon. It was Levi who we think opened up his bag and found the money at first. They didn't send him back to rescue Shimon. They ate their food. And only when they ran out of food and they were in trouble again did they think of rescuing Shimon. So, now we pick up at verse 18. Then Judah went up to him, that would be Joseph, and he said, pardon your servant, my lord. Let me speak a word to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant, though you are equal to Pharaoh himself. Well, it sounds like he is getting ready to make a request. This was in a day when people used to be polite, especially when different people had authority and were sometimes prone to act violently. Verse 19. My lord asked his servants, do you have a father or a brother? And we answered, we have an aged father, and there is a young son born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him. And then you said to your servants, bring him down to me so I can see him for myself. And we said to my lord, the boy cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, his father will die. But you told your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what my lord had said. And then our father said, go back and buy a little more food. But we said, we cannot go down, only if our youngest brother is with us will we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. And your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons, and one of them went away with me and said, he has surely been, and I said, he has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. So now, this is Judah speaking to Joseph. And this is important to remember, it's Judah speaking. If the boy is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now, just let's clarify this again at verse 32. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. Notice how he has shifted. Earlier, the father had been called the servant of Joseph because he's showing that all of them are submitted and accept his authority. But now, when he refers to himself, he says, your servant. And he doesn't say your servant made a promise to your other servant. He says my father, because now the focus of the request and who is submitted to Joseph is going to be Judah. And so he says, now then, please let your servant remain here as the Lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come down on my father. And I would like to stop there, and because I think that is a... We're going to continue reading in just a minute. But I want to stop and let this sink in. Who is doing the talking, and what do you think of his action?
He's repentant.
Judah's doing the talking.
Judah's doing the talking, and
he sounds transparent.
Is this revenge? Is this business as usual for him? Or has he been pushed out of character?
Well, he's certainly pleading.
He's certainly pleading.
Pleading in a new way. It's like his guilt.
It's a shiny moment.
It's a shiny moment.
It's Judah's shining moment. What had Judah done before this point? Well, when Joseph was in the pit, Judah said, well, maybe we can get some advantage. Instead of just killing him ourselves, let's sell him into slavery and get some money. That was Judah. And it was Judah then who came up with the idea to deceive the father. Judah is the one that took the coat of Joseph that he used to get every year, you know, maybe his birthday or whenever an old coat wore out, his father gave him a new coat. So they brought him Joseph's coat, bloody. That was Judah. And it was Judah that went off and didn't honor his sons when they were trying to get grandchildren for Judah. Tamar Tamar was supposed to be promised to the youngest son, but Judah withheld him, and so Tamar had to do a trick, and it was Tamar who used the same words and made the presentation to Judah. You know, recognize these things, just like Judah said to his father, recognize these things. So this is Judah. This is the background of Judah.
Sheila's expression, Judah's shining moment, is really good.
It is, it is. Now, Judah did step in and he did go surety. He wanted, he made the promise but he didn't actually have, he made the promise to his father, but he didn't actually put himself at risk yet. In other words, it was, he took a promise about the future, but at this point, Judah actually he's saying, put me in jail. Make me an Egyptian slave for life. So at this point, he's making good on a promise. It is his shining moment. And he is offering to give himself up for Benjamin.
Reflecting his character.
I'm sorry?
Reflecting his character.
Well, bringing a good part of his character out. We've just itemized that he's had some bad sides to his character also. But here is his something good. It's reflecting something very good, something noble. And this is, Jesus says, no man has greater love than this, than he give his life as...
He lays down his life for a friend.
Yeah, but it doesn't look like he's doing it for his brother, he's doing it for his father.
Yes, he's doing it for his father. That's true. He is doing this for his father, but he's still giving his life for his father. And of course, he's giving his life in exchange for his brother's life so that his brother would be let free. So this is an example that, according to Jesus, is the greatest kind of love, where one person gives their life to save another. So this is Judah's finest moment, and I don't want to lose that here, because this family has been, well, we keep using this modern word, dysfunctional. This family has been very dysfunctional, but here comes something good. Yes, good things can come out, you know, messed up people can turn and do good things. And that should give us hope. Anyway, let's start reading again.
Do you think the trigger for laying down his life for his friend, for his father in this case, is that guilt has finally caught up with him? Do we see that?
Well, they've already said that last week. We talked, you know, they said our guilt has caught up with us. So that's part of it. But the guilt at that stage only caused panic.
Right.
So how you respond to that is the big thing. Now, why didn't any of the other brothers step forward? Well, maybe because it was Judah who had made that promise to the father in the first place, and they had, Judah's promise had, you know, the other brothers didn't all chime in and say, no, let me do it, you know. Judah's promise to his father had apparently been accepted. He was the one bearing the responsibility, so he's the one that came through here. If you want to think of a trigger, I would say it's not the guilt, I think it's the promise to the father. It's the promise to the father that Judah feels responsible for, and he takes that so seriously that he is willing to put his life on the line for it. So that's huge.
Yeah, but do you think that's part of the problem? Part of the problem is Yaakov, because it says here, you know that my wife heard me. He's saying, my wife bore me two sons. Like, they're his favorite sons, right?
They're his favorite sons.
His wife gave him more than two sons, you know?
Absolutely. No, it's... We are not excusing the rest of them, but that isn't what caused Judah to become honorable. the trigger was his promise, and in implementing his promise, he was able to go to the most extreme extent possible to risk his own life because of that promise. And that it was at this point here, and at the end of chapter 44, that he makes good and steps forward in the greatest example of love. Now, let's go on. Joseph could no longer control himself. And if you want to think, is this an example of this greatest example of love? I think the reaction of Joseph was triggered by that. He recognized what a degree, and he sees this as a reversal of character. You know, these Judah, the one who sold me into Egypt. You know, Davka Judah, you know, is now willing to give his life for a brother. And that just ripped him apart. He couldn't control himself. And he cried out. He pushes him to the wall and he cries out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly the Egyptians heard him. And Pharaoh's household heard about it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Oh, Davinu Hai. So,
he wanted a force on them to be pushed to the wall. It's almost like he wanted to force on them a Joseph number two and see what they would do. Are you gonna, I want to see if you, in a similar situation, would you do the same thing?
So I want to get that comment in case they couldn't hear it on this. Although these phones are remarkable.
He kind of forced a Joseph number two.
I'm going to repeat that to make. So this is an example in case this phone doesn't pick up comments. This is an example of Joseph number two. With Joseph number one, they failed. They sold their brother, the favorite son, off into slavery. And here is favorite son number two. So it's a second test. And Joseph pushed him into a second test, and this time they reversed themselves and
Benjamin
stood.
Benjamin is number two. I've got it now.
Yes,
Benjamin is
number two. He's second favorite son number two.
Sorry, I didn't get it.
He's favorite son number two. Anyway, they're terrified. Here is this most remarkable scene. If you read it from Joseph's perspective, he has just seen this act of selfless love for the father and for a favorite son, and he can't control himself when he sees this selfless love. But the brothers, with all of their guilt, they don't rejoice at this. They are absolutely in panic. They were terrified at his presence. And then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. Do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no plowing and reaping." And there is this link with the plowing and reaping that we read in Amos. And God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of the entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you and your children and grandchildren, your flocks and herds and all that you have. I will provide for you there because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute. You can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it is really I who am speaking to you. Tell my father about all the honor accorded to me in Egypt and about everything you have seen, and bring my father down here quickly. And then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept. And Benjamin embraced him weeping, and he kissed all of his brothers and wept over them. And afterwards, his brothers talked with him. And when the news reached Pharaoh's palace that Joseph's brothers had come, Pharaoh and all his officials were pleased. Well, they were pleased. The brothers are still trying to figure things out. Pharaoh said to Joseph, tell your brothers, do this, load your animals, return to the land of Canaan, bring your father and your families back to me. I will give you the best land of Egypt, and you can enjoy the fat of the land. You are also directed to tell them, do this. Take some carts from Egypt for your children and wives, and get your father and come. Never mind about your belongings. The best of all Egypt will be yours. So the sons of Israel did this. Notice the name change. This isn't Jacob, it's Israel, the covenantal name. So the sons of Israel did this. Joseph gave them carts as Pharaoh had commanded, and he gave them provisions for their journey. To each of them he gave new clothing. But to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 sets of clothes. Okay. Well, this was his brother with the same mother. So probably people could understand that. This may not have caused the kind of jealousy that it would have if they were all, it's not quite the same, but it would be a little bit in our day and age if we had a lot of wealth and we gave a very large portion to our brother or sister, and then we gave lots of smaller portions to our cousins. They're not exactly cousins. They're same father, but different mothers. So I just say that so that you see this in perspective. So this may not have caused the same kind of jealousy that the father's actions, for instance, caused at the beginning of chapter 37.
The question here is that he says that it was God who did this.
Yes.
Why do you have this whole drama of killing your brother and so on and so forth? Why does God need to work like that?
Why does God what?
Need to work that way. I mean, can't God figure out a more moral way to do that?
That's a very good question. God was at work this way. Couldn't he have done it a different way? And the answer is, of course he could have done it a different way. And this is one of the awesome and scary aspects of God. God works with his people without forcing them like robots. Well, it does. That's, people say that. That's not in the Bible. That's a common summary that is true. that God works in mysterious ways. He can take evil and make good out of it. And
yeah, but it says that he intended this to happen.
Yes, he intended to save them, but his intentions also were to use and to allow the freedom of people. He does not force people
to be good
into one thing or another. He lets people do their good and their evil. There is true freedom to his people, and yet God is the master chess player. He can even turn evil into good. So God, as the master chess player, takes people, gives them freedom, but by using their freedom, is able to manipulate events to bring about his larger purposes. This is a mystery that people of faith, from Abraham's day to the present, have always wrestled with. And it's part of the very nature of God. And this is why you can't take away freedom from people and call it godly. God is the author of freedom. Right from the Garden of Eden, if you're free to do what you want. Why didn't God stop it? Well, because God works with people whom he's given full moral choice to. And taking away moral choice is a mark of the devil. No, the laws direct your moral choice. Your law says this is right, this is wrong. I'm sorry?
You make the wrong moral choice according to the civil law, you go to prison.
That's true. That's right. But they don't take away your choice. Now,
you say it's in the parable of the prodigal son, why? Because if you accept the idea that the father is God, our first instinct is to say, what a rotten father, giving the son all his money and all the rest of it.
Excuse me.
But when you look at it, the children are being given complete freedom.
I really agree with what you say, that God brings good out of everything, like Romans 8:28, for example. Mm-hmm. He turns all things to good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. In 45:16, I think that the actions of Joseph touched Pharaoh's home so much. They gave me this impression, our actions of forgiveness will greatly influence those around us to follow Jesus and do the same. It's God can bring so much good out of the situation. When the people around us are witnessing forgiveness and love towards one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, although they were assuming they were seeing. I would just like to add one thing. That was, everything in your comment is good. However, I'm not sure that we're seeing all of the love yet. I'm not sure that that Pharaoh and the others saw the love. They were assuming the love, hearing about Joseph's weeping. They heard about the love, as it were, from Joseph's perspective. They were not aware of the fear and the panic that were inside the brothers. They didn't see that, I think.
That fear and panic actually goes on, really, on and on, even to the point when he's dead, Joseph's dead. They've still got this anxiety that there's going to be some sort of retribution. They're never really through.
Right, at the end of the book, Genesis 50. But there's a couple more things we need to read and cover before the end here. So let's go on. The sons of Israel did this, verse 21. Joseph gave them carts as Pharaoh commanded. He also gave them provisions for their journey. To each of them, And this is what he sent his father, 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and provisions for his journey. Then he sent his brothers away, and as they were leaving, he said to them, "Don't quarrel on the way." Now, there is, it's actually, the Hebrew there is actually a little al-til-gizu. It isn't completely clear what that means, because there is a passage in Exodus 15 in the Song of Moses. It talks about the nations have heard about what God has done, and they have v'yirgizu. And the meaning is to be like to be in an uproar, not necessarily angry, but maybe fearful. And people have thought that this, in the history of interpretation, they have, you know, this translation, "Don't quarrel on the way," is one of the streams of translation. Don't get angry with each other on the way for what you have done. That is one interpretation. But another one is, don't be upset. Don't put yourselves into an uproar about what's going to happen. You don't have to fear. You don't have to fear your journey. You're going to be going with the full authority and backing of Egypt. Things are going to work out. They're going to be, you know, don't be afraid of this journey. That's another stream of interpretation. And the Hebrew isn't 100% clear. It does sound, the most common meaning is don't get angry. Don't get angry on the way, but it doesn't say what, and it could mean don't get upset.
Don't become troubled.
Don't become troubled, fearful on the way. And in any case, it doesn't explain what they would become upset, fearful, or angry about. All of that has to be filled in. But let's go on. Our time is going. So they went up out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. Ah, we're back to Jacob again. Look at that. And they told him, "Joseph is still alive. In fact, he is ruler of all Egypt." And Jacob was stunned, and he didn't believe them. But when they told him everything Joseph said to them, and when he saw the carts that he sent to carry him back, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, and now as it shifts back to someone acting along, we might say, the covenant of promise and faith. And Israel said, "I am convinced. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." So Israel set out with all that was his, and when he reached Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. So that's, I guess that would be like a long day's journey by foot from Hebron to Beersheba. And God spoke to Israel in a vision, and he said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." "I am God, the God of your father," he said. "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you. I will surely bring you back again, and Joseph's own hand will close your eyes." Now, this is very important for understanding the whole book of Genesis. You remember the three stories where one of the patriarchs, first Abraham twice, and then Isaac, says, "She's my sister." Well, the first time, Abraham goes down to Egypt. He leaves the promised land. And it's pretty clear from the story that she is in the harem long enough to have spent time with the Pharaoh. Now, the second time, Abraham does not go to Egypt. The second time there's a famine, he goes to Grau. And uses the same ruse. But this time is not as bad. He does not leave the land. And when Isaac repeats this same thing, he doesn't leave the land, and it specifically, there's a word in there saying, don't leave the land. And, you know, God intervenes, and specifically with Isaac, God intervenes, and the man said, and I didn't touch your wife. He doesn't say that, you know, the first time with Abraham and the Pharaoh. But with Isaac, you get an extra benefit, and I didn't touch your wife. That's what the king of Gerar says. The principle, though, is these people are leaving the land, and leaving the land for the patriarchs is a very serious thing to consider, because God said, go to the land that I promised to give you. So here is Jacob ready to do what his grandfather did. And God, now he's already made the commitment, but he's probably having doubts. Am I doing the right thing? I'm leaving the land. And at this point, God intervenes and says, yes, go down to Egypt. God did not intervene with Abraham and say, yes, go down to Egypt. With Abraham, instead, there's a covenant made in chapter 15 where Abraham cuts the sacrifices into pieces, and God comes and speaks to him with a curse, saying, your children are going to be in the land of Egypt, or in the land of their persecutors.
So why did he have to, because he sent them there to make them into a great nation, why did he have to send them to Egypt to become a great nation?
Well, I don't know. Well, in this case, it saves them from a famine, and it also plays out with the overall, you might call it the overall poetic justice. Abraham left the land. God punishes him. He gives them a promise, and your children are going to be abused in this land.
It says here, he's going to build them into a great nation.
Yes. Now, this time, the first time when Abraham goes down, he gets this promise that's like a curse. Later, Abraham doesn't leave the land. He goes to Gerar. Gerar is still in the land of promise. And Isaac goes to Gerar, still in the land of promise. And Jacob is in Beersheba. He's getting ready to leave the land. And I think he was having doubts. In any case, it's at this point that he gets a vision. God meets him in the night and says, it's okay, go down to Egypt. I'm going to make you a great nation there, and I'm going to bring you back. Even though in the past I have dealt severely with Abraham leaving the land, and I told him that his descendants were going to be in a foreign land and persecuted, this is good for you to leave the land, and you will be blessed.
It's another example, isn't it, of the way God brings the whole story together. Abraham's told that they're going to be in a foreign land and persecuted, whatever, for 400 years, and that is fulfilled, you know, when another Pharaoh comes up, that's what happens. But at this moment in time, you're being told it's okay to do what I'm telling you.
That is correct. Now, one more thing we have to read through quickly to get to the end. And it's mostly names, but they tell us a story. I want to read it. Then Jacob left Beersheba, and Israel's sons took their father Jacob and their children and wives in the carts that Pharaoh sent to transport them. So Jacob and all his offspring went to Egypt, taking with them their livestock and the possessions they had acquired in Canaan. He brought them to Egypt. his sons and grandsons and daughters and granddaughters, all of his offspring. These are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his descendants, who went to Egypt. Reuben, the firstborn of Jacob, the sons of Reuben, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi, the sons of Shimon, Yemuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yakin, Zohar, and Shaul, son of a Canaanite woman, the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohat, Merari, the sons of Judah, Er, Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. But Er and Onan had died in the land of Canaan. Now, look at how this is being taken care of. These are those that went down to Egypt, and Er and Onan are listed. And I'm pointing this out because the way that the Bible looks at the family and the way that these lists are given are not the way we would expect. They may not be the way we have like a county office that registers births and deaths, and you have an office that will register land sales in most governments today. So this list is not given that way because Er and Onan did not go down, and yet they're included in the list. It's as if to say that because their replacement was made, that Judah and Tamar ended up fulfilling the promise of descendants through the others, they're all listed as if they went down. And this also will come up, this whole question as to how you list people, is there's a difference in Acts 7:14. It says 75 people went down, and it is following a different list because there are different ways you can put these lists together. It's not that one is more right or more wrong. There are different ways of doing it. And I share that because our job when we read an ancient text is to figure out how they are gathering the text and how they're reporting it and to interpret it according to their ways. And so in their way, Er and Onan have been taken care of by the levirate marriage, and they get included in the list.
That gives us hope for our family members, doesn't it?
It gives hope for our family members. Anyway, they are in the list. Even though they had died. So I'm going to read quickly. Sons of Issachar, Tola, Pua, Yashuv, Shimron, the sons of Zebulon, Sarad, Elon, Yahlel. These were the sons Leah bore to Jacob in Padan Aram, besides his daughter Dinah. These sons and daughters of his were 33 in all. And the sons of Gad, Tsephon, Hagi, Shuni, Etzbon, Eri, Arodi, Araeli. The sons of Asher, Imna, Ishva, Ishvi, and Briah. Their sister was Serah. And the sons of Briah were Hever and Malkiel. And these were the children born to Jacob by Zilpah, whom Laban had given to his daughter Leah, 16 in all. And the sons of Jacob's wife, Rachel, Joseph, and Binyamin in Egypt. Manasseh, Ephraim, were born to Joseph by Asnat, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And the sons of Benjamin, Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Mupim, Hupim, and Arub. These were the sons of Rachel, whom were born to Jacob, 14 in all. And the son of Dan, Hushim, and the sons of Naphtali, Yahziel, Guni, Yezer, Shilem. These were born to Jacob by Bilhah, whom Laban had given to his daughter Rachel, 7 in all. All those who went to Egypt with Jacob, those who were his direct descendants, not counting his sons' wives, numbered 66 persons. And with the two sons who had been born to Joseph in Egypt, the members of Jacob's family which went to Egypt were 70 in all. And there are different ways to get that 70 figure, depending on how you want to configure what we've just read. Now, Jacob, I think that was the end. That was the end. So we will leave the rest. We'll leave the rest for the next week. But we are seeing a God who does not spare hardship and does not force people into doing things against their will. He gives us free will, and yet he plays with us to bring about good. And I just say that because, I'll just make one last comment. There are 1.6 billion people in the world that are under a death threat if they change their religion. Now, that is not God. God is not the God that takes away free will. That death threat is from the devil. God is a God that gives people free will and is a God of justice who works out justice. When people do wrong things, he works out justice. And God, in his wisdom, is the grand chess player who will bring about his purposes working with fallen people. People who make mistakes that need judgment, that need justice, and yet God, through it all, can bring about good and his purposes. And so this Joseph story is truly a remarkable and an encouraging story, I think, to every believer through all history. And right now we're looking at close to 4,000 years of history, at least 3.5 millennia. So, Shabbat Shalom.